This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast last year in November.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Chad Ford is our guest for the hour. This is our latest in an ongoing series on peace building. He says his book, Dangerous Love, is about everything I've learned over the years working as a conflict mediator, professor, and researcher, trying to understand why I and others struggle through conflict and how to solve it. We'll talk a bit about that, Dangerous Love. Chad Ford is an associate professor of religious studies and on the faculty advisory board of the Hiravi Peace Institute, which is in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. He specializes in intercultural and religious peace building, and his work as peace educator, conflict mediator, and facilitator has frequently taken him out of the classroom into conflict zones around the world. He's made more than 50 trips to the Middle East. He's worked as a mediator and facilitator on numerous other conflicts around the world in Ireland, Cyprus, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Oceania, China, and throughout the United States. Sits on the executive board of nonprofit Peace Players. Chad Ford, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We had a conversation a couple of years ago by telephone. You were at BYU Hawaii.
Correct, yeah.
So welcome to USU.
Thanks. It's given me quite a welcome this morning with the snow flurries.
With the snow, right. I guess you didn't have that in Hawaii, probably.
Did not have that in Hawaii, and it is funny being in Logan when I tell people I'm from Hawaii. With about a 90% accuracy, I can guess what they're going to ask next, which is, why in the world would you leave Hawaii to come to Logan, Utah?
Yeah, why in the world would you leave Hawaii?
You know, it is a good question. It was not an easy decision. I'd been there 20 years. And it really actually has a lot to do with Utah State and the Hiravi Peace Institute and Patrick Mason and Tammy Proctor and Colin Flint and a number of professors here that I really thought were onto something about what they were building at Utah State. I had experience building something in Hawaii, looking for the next adventure. I have some family in Utah as well, and just really excited about what's happening at Utah State right now and just to be a part of it.
Well, it's good to have you here. So how did you get into this whole area, conflict resolution, peace building?
Yeah, when I was a undergraduate student, I became really interested. I was a history major, and I became really interested. I noticed I was gravitating to conflict. I was writing a lot about conflicts that had been happening historically. I was really curious about why they were happening. I was especially interested in the civil rights movement that had happened in the 60s and what was going on in Northern Ireland, where my ancestors had come from, and didn't know what to do with that afterwards. I was like, should I be a history professor or a teacher? And I had a mentor there who was an attorney, a human rights attorney, who was working with indigenous Hawaiians, who really encouraged me to go to law school. So I decided, hey, great. No one in my family had ever really at that time graduated from college, let alone gone on to grad school. But I thought that was just a good idea. And so I ended up going to Georgetown Law and was going to focus on sort of international and human rights law. When I met Dennis Ross, who was the chief negotiator for Middle East peace at the time for the United States government, who'd just come onto campus to do a lecture about the Middle East peace process. And I just became fascinated. I talked with him after his lecture. He pointed me to a program that's now called the Carter Center for Peace at George Mason. And I ended up doing a joint degree in law and conflict analysis and resolution right out of grad school. Ended up going back to Northern Ireland, where my ancestors had come from, to work on the peace agreements there as an intern for the United Nations. And you know, since then, I've just kept diving deeper and deeper into what causes conflict, how to transform it, and have worked on everything from child custody cases to community work, all the way up to doing work for the U.S. State Department in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I want to jump right in. By the way, parenthetically, people may have known you in years past as a NBA analyst.
Yeah.
kind of a... side gig that you had?
I think a lot of people are surprised that was the side gig, but it really was ever since 2005. And I covered the NBA and NBA draft for ESPN. And I had done it full time for several years before that, as I created a website and sold that while I was in grad school to ESPN. But I just felt the call. to the challenges that were happening in the world. I sold my website right before 9/11 happened, like right before that. And, you know, all the things that started happening in the United States since then began to pull me back in the direction of conflict. And then I sort of did part-time ESPN NBA, and then 2017, I just had too much work, too much going on to really be able to do that anymore. But I love that. I love that gig as well. Love basketball.
So there's conflicts all over the world, right? There's war. There's conflicts in families. There's you've made many trips to the Middle East. We'll get talking about that, I'm sure, during the hour. I don't want to start with our national conflict. We, you know, seemed like our 50-year-long election finally ended, right, with former President Trump winning. And illustrated here on UPR, we did a program right after the election, and Jennifer Invernal called in and represents, I'm sure, many of the millions, the half of the country. She said she was sick to her stomach. And then I got an email later on from Rob Roy, who was a Trump supporter, said he's jubilant. Right. And I think they stand in for, you know, 50-50 or whatever it might be. Right.
Maybe like 30-30 with a big group in the middle that isn't
that's true.
What's going to happen.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Yes.
Have mixed motivations about what might happen. You know, there was a lot of talk about fake news during the election and, you know, in politics, it's increasingly the case that politicians don't tell the truth to their supporters or to the people they're trying to recruit. But if there was one falsehood that I think was prevalent that has led to this reaction that you're talking about, was that somehow this election was going to solve things for us, one way or the other, right? Yeah. Either Harris was going to save us or Trump was going to save us, mm-hmm. right? And really, really strong beliefs on the different sides about which of those answers
or prevent disaster,
be.
Right?
Or to prevent disaster.
Which amounts to the same thing, right?
Right, yeah. Save America, right, from the other side. And as someone who's worked a lot in conflict and especially in a lot of socio-political conflict, that I was never under that illusion. Whoever was going to win, there was going to be roughly 50% of the country that was going to lose. And in a democracy, in a community sort of setting, you can't have a situation and thrive where 50% gets the lord over the other 50% and make their life miserable because they won the election. There's Trump supporters who felt that way under Joe Biden. There were Hillary Clinton supporters who felt that way under President Trump. And what it leads to is increasing division, increasing polarization, increasing feeling like the only way that I can make progress in America is by defeating my neighbor, right? They have to lose so that I can win. And as someone who's worked as a mediator for years in family conflict and community conflict, international conflict, that is a recipe for disaster. That is not going to solve our problems, win or lose an election. And so, you know, to me, the hard work began the day after the election now. And that's where I think all of us have to start to focus, whether we're happy with the outcome of the election, whether we're devastated with the outcome of the election, or whether we're just unsure, unsteady about what is going to happen next. The past will not determine our future. It's actually what we do right now. And we have a lot of work to do.
And so we'll get into some solutions and help you feel hopeful. I want to depress people a little further
sure.
before we get there. So you have a story that you on your website, story you tell. This always strikes me when I read it. It's a man trying to reach out to his children. His name is Hank.
Right.
And so I guess you can tell it. He writes a letter saying, and is we should know, set this up. Hank is a Trump supporter. He's a little older, Fox News watching, kind of the stereotype. His children are more progressive. So there's a divide there.
Right.
And he's trying to reach out to them.
Yeah. And he writes a history of his life. And he's packaged it up. He's sending it to all of his kids. He starts with a letter and says, look, I know that there's going to be some religious beliefs in here, some political beliefs, some other things that you might disagree with. but remember, this is about me, right? And I'm just trying to share my story in my life with you. And as you can imagine, to various degrees, his children had a really strong reaction. I actually read the whole document. And one of the things that struck me was there was, of course, a lot of just biographical information, storytelling, how I met your mom, you know, how I started this business or what have you. But it was infused throughout it with commentary that sounded exactly like you would hear Sean Hannity or Tucker Carlson or sort of talking about the state of America today. And so the children, that's what they heard. That's what they saw. That's what they related to. And one of his daughters, his youngest daughter, ends up calling him and having an explosive conversation that ends with her saying, I have to cut you out of my life. You're toxic and I can't talk to you anymore. And for Hank, he was stunned, absolutely stunned. How could she reject me, my life, all the things that I've learned, my wisdom, right, over politics?
So this hits me because I'm sure this happens in families all over, and especially as it kind of hits a crescendo. The election has ended, and we go to a transition. But those are temptations, right? You're so toxic, I got to cut you out.
Yeah,
right. I can't. Or if I don't cut you out, we just can't talk politics, right?
Right.
And that in some cases might be the solution, right?
Right. But, sometimes.
Or I'm just going to retreat from the political, or on the winning side, there probably are some percentage of Trump supporters saying, okay, now we won the election, now we'll inflict pain on the other side, right?
Yes, and vice versa, when Biden won.
Yeah.
We're going to go after those Trumpers and what we think they did, to America. And, you know, those reactions to me are all evidence of fear, right? When we respond to conflict by either fleeing, which is I'm cutting you out, I'm moving out of the country, I'm not following you on social media anymore, I'm starting to block people out of my life, I'm blocking you on my phone. That's all a fleeing response, which is a really natural response to fear. And there are good reasons, by the way, for people to be fearful, right? The rhetoric in both political campaigns did not feel inclusive to the other side, even though they might actually, the people saying it might say it's inclusive, they didn't feel inclusive. There are a lot of people right now that think in the next 4 years, this is not going to be a safe place for me to live. And there were a lot of people in the last 4 years that felt like America wasn't a particularly safe place for them to live. And so those are natural reaction. And then the other one is to fight, right? So what we can't do is flee here. Now I got to call up. I got to scream at you on the phone. I got to double and triple down on my social media post. I got to think about every possible way of obstructing, getting in the way of the other side. We have to figure out how to defeat them. And now that we've lost the election, what are alternative ways of defeating the other side? And again, a reaction to fear. And then the third one, which I a lot of people have done, which is to freeze, right? They're just paralyzed. Mm. I think you talked about a listener said that they were sick to their stomach and they couldn't leave the house.
Yeah, that's the other thing that Jennifer said. Yeah. Jennifer, I hope you're feeling a little bit better.
Yeah,
I recognize that it's very, very painful. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so they freeze. And while all of these are physiological responses to fear that can serve us well when we're experiencing physical danger, for example, right? We had a mountain lion show up in our yard. Welcome to Logan. The other day, and you know, the reaction to try to flee or the adrenaline that comes in those cases is probably wise. When it comes to our personal relationships, our family, our kids, our spouses, our neighbors, the people in our congregation and our faith communities, those reactions don't serve us well. They actually tend to escalate and pour gasoline onto the fire, and then we stand back and say, "Well, why is this getting worse? I'm doing these tactics that I think are going to protect me, but all they do is widen the gap between people." And so, part of the reason for Dangerous Love, why I called the book Dangerous Love, is our instinct is to fight or to flee or to freeze. But what we actually need to do in those moments when we feel threatened, when we feel like the world is shutting down around us, is to reach out and do something that lately, it's not actually in Dangerous Love, but in a new book that I'm writing, I call The Risk of Embrace. We actually have to start taking some risks now of getting curious about the people that we're in conflict with, trying to deepen our understanding about why they're making the choices that they're making, recognizing that often the choices they're making are often also related to fear, right? And the fear that something is going to go wrong in their life. And how do we find the space and create the space, frankly, to embrace each other and try to find ways to collaboratively solve our problems?
So I want to pick that up before we go to break. Curious about the other side, right? Would have been the opposite, 4 years ago, but let's just take the perspective of a Harris supporter.
Okay.
Or an ever-Trumper, an ex-Republican, whatever you want to say, who I could see saying, yeah, I hear you, Chad Ford. I'd probably need to be curious, but these folks, whatever their motivation, are well on their way to ruining my country. Right. So what would you say to them?
And they might say something to me also, by the way, if they're a Harris supporter of, check your privilege, Chad. Yeah. You're a white male. You're going to be fine. Right. Right? What about all the people that are already feeling under threat? What about people that are already marginalized in our communities? And it sounds like, given the rhetoric of President Trump, that we're going to be in more danger, if you will. And I just want to start by saying, I'm not trying to discount the fear. I understand why the fear is strong and why it actually is a little bit easier for me to maybe say, hey, what we should do here is lean into our fear instead of running away or fighting or what have you. But I think that part of my work has taught me that is a dynamic that exists in every sort of conflict, regardless of your gender, regardless of your race, regardless of your socioeconomic status. Fear has a way of taking over and telling you, even in situations like, let's think about white males in the United States for a second, they are clearly in a privileged position compared to other groups in America. But many Trump supporters actually didn't feel that way. They actually saw it differently. They thought that white males were under attack. And whether you agree with them or not, whether you want to get into the facts of whether that was actually true or not, in conflict, our perceptions are our realities, right? We are going to be operating off our perception of the world, regardless of whether that is the world that we should see. And so when a Harris supporter or a Trump supporter says, well, I have good reason to be afraid, I take that very seriously, right? My perception of what's happening right now is that I'm under threat. My only reaction back to them is, what does cutting out, what does fleeing, what does freezing, does fighting actually get you where you want to go? Right? Is it actually going to produce the results that you think it should produce? And if you're a Harris supporter and say, absolutely, I'd say, then what happened in the last election? Because there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of stark differences that were made. There was warnings that were given to Americans about what would happen under a Trump presidency. All sorts of behaviors were brought to light and under the glare of the media, and people still chose Trump. It makes me think, was it the most effective strategy? And maybe we need to not just double down on what didn't work, but instead maybe try to find something that does.
Right. Let's do go to break now. We're talking with Chad Ford. He is associate professor of religious studies at Utah State University. He's on the faculty advisory board of the Haravi Peace Institute. Author of Dangerous Love. We're going to be talking about that. And there's a new book coming out. What's the title of that?
70 times 7, Jesus' Path to Conflict Transformation.
All right. That'll be coming out soon. We'll have more with Chad Ford following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in November of last year.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. This is another episode in our peacebuilding series. We're pleased to have Chad Ford with us. He's author of Dangerous Love. He's associate professor of religious studies and on the faculty advisory board of the Haravi Peace Institute at Utah State University. Let's start to bring the hope a little bit here. So tell me, you know, don't have to give particulars, but, the clients you work with, are they able to resolve conflicts?
Absolutely. Does it always work? No. Because again, so much of this is about us, but let's talk about some things that we might want to do. And these are easier said than done, right? But the first thing I need to do is I need to start thinking about how I'm seeing others. Am I seeing them as people? Am I seeing them as objects? And maybe even more importantly, that's sort of a Martin Buber type of idea. He called it I, it, I, thou. And I think it's really helpful. But also sort of thinking about seeing myself in relationship to people. And one way that I could sort of think about it is that the space between us. I came out of this sort of Polynesian culture, and they had a term for this. They called it the va. One of the primary cultural attributes of a Tongan or a Samoan is that you do the tahi va. You work the va, right? You sort of think about the space between us. I'm never me alone. I'm always me in relationship to someone else right now, right? And you see this in America. There's a broken va. If you will, right, that the space between us, there's something that is really off there. And so we're going to tahi va. And part of that is looking at people who I'm in conflict with, and instead of seeing them as evil, instead of seeing them as somehow they don't count the same way that I count, their views, opinions, attitudes are somehow invalid, why mine are valid, we need to start seeing them as people. Their needs, wants, and desires matter just as much to them as my needs, wants, and desires matter to me. And even if I don't agree with those needs or those desires or those beliefs, it helps me to be able to collaborate with them when I understand where those needs, desires, and beliefs are coming from. And I think one of the problems that we have in our political discourse is we're quick to dehumanize people in the way that we speak about them, the labels that we put on them, how quick we are to judge intent based off things people say and do in ways that, again, are often dehumanizing. And so the first thing I have to take a step back is say, okay, I could just say that my neighbor is evil because they voted for Harris, or my neighbor is evil because they voted for Trump. But I think there's another way to think about this is that there were reasons that my neighbor voted for that I might not understand. There are complex reasons why they chose and made the choices that they made. And, you know, Patrick Mason told me a story the other day that I thought was really fascinating with his mother, who was a Harris supporter. And she was at church and really feeling it after the election. And there was this man that she hated in her congregation who was a very strong, vocal Trump supporter who shocked her by coming up to her after church and saying to her simply, "This must have been a really hard week for you." She was floored that he would say it. It seemed sincere. It wasn't a gloating, "This must be a hard week for you," with like a smile and a wink in his eye. It seemed that he was genuinely concerned about her. Now, of course, he was obviously happy about the outcome of the election, but he recognized that there are people in my community that are hurting right now. And he took the time to reach out. That to me is seeing someone as a person, right? Understanding that even though I might not agree about the outcome, I can recognize that you're happy right now, or you're scared, or you're upset. And I'm going to lean into that right now and show that I have care or concern for you right now. If there's a first to do, I would say, if you're a Harris supporter or a Trump supporter, is recognize and validate to a certain extent the emotion. You don't have to validate whether they were right or wrong, but validate the emotion. It must have been a good week for you. I know you were really concerned about the direction of our country, and it seems like that, you know, a lot of people agreed with you and that now the country is going in a direction that you really hoped for. I really hope, you know, in some ways that's given you some peace or happiness. Or I know what didn't go your way, and I can see that you're really struggling right now. What could I do to help you feel safe or feel better about the way the direction goes? I really believe this was the right decision for America, but I know that you don't. And where can we find common ground? Right? That to me is seeing the humanity of someone. Gloating on one hand, coming to them and say, yeah, you were wrong, loser, we're going to make your life miserable. Definitely not seeing the humanity of someone. Screaming at someone and calling them a sexist or a racist or a horrible person or a Hitler lover or whatever because they supported President Trump also doesn't, to me, really sort of reek of seeing the humanity of people, nor does it seem to be very conducive to collaborative problem solving. And that seems like such a simple step. But I think it's like one all of us could actually take like today with a text message, with a conversation with someone right now, recognize the pain or recognize the relief that people are experiencing or the uncertainty that people are feeling right now and just take some time to listen and trying to understand and show a little empathy because we all know what it's like to feel scared, to feel lost, to have things not go our way. Trump supporters certainly know what this feels like, right, to have lost the election. Harris supporters know what it feels like to have won an election because they probably were supporting Joe Biden in 2020 and know what that's like as well. So we all should have this common set of experiences and feelings and emotions. Can we reach out to each other right now and actually connect at the beginning over that?
Now, one thing I was reading, you said sometimes you can either be right or you can have peace.
Right.
Right. And I'm sure there is an element of that on either side that I'm absolutely right. You know, Harris supporter, the country now is going to go to hell in a handbasket, and I warned you. Or, you know, Trump supporter, you know, saying, you know, Trump said, I'm your retribution. Now it's time for retribution, whatever it might be. I'm absolutely right. I can't get there to seek to understand you. What would you say to that person?
It's human. Right. I've actually had Harris supporters come to me and say, I can't wait until the Trump supporters realize that he actually is Hitler. I can't wait for that moment. And I'm like, really? I hope that moment doesn't come. Mm-hmm. Right. I hope that's wrong. I understand why you feel that way, but I certainly don't hope that that's the outcome that we see here. Or, on the other side, this idea of retribution, you harassed President Trump for the last 4 years. Now we're going to harass you. We're going to harass your followers in certain ways. And you're going to know what it's like for us for the last 4 years. I hope that's not the case. If you really felt like those 4 years were miserable for you and that you felt under threat, is that really what you want the next 4 years to look like just for someone else right now? Wouldn't it be amazing to actually change that situation if that's how you felt? And it's so interesting to me because what people say they want in conflict most of the time is I want peace, I want respect, I want trust, I want validation, I want people to recognize my humanity. But the things that we think and say and do often invite the very opposite of that, Tom. And those are those moments when I'm sitting with him and saying, okay, so what you're telling me is that you really wish this Trump supporter would respect you more, but everything that you're saying and doing is heaping disrespect on them. What is their likely reaction to that going to be, right? And it's contempt breeds contempt, right? And so if I want to lessen the feeling of contempt, which I feel is a very dangerous emotion, Gottman, who's a researcher in marriages and probably the most prominent researcher in America on marriages, says contempt is like the number one emotion that predicts divorce. And, you know, divorce is awful when it comes to a family, what it does to the children. But a country, we cannot survive that. Our prosperous history, 200-year plus history, is in deep, deep danger if divorce is the direction that we're heading.
I want to talk about the dangerous part of dangerous love. And you've talked about that fear, right? That fear is real. So you told the story of Hank and his daughter, Rebecca. I'm sure that's the last thing he wanted when he wrote this letter is for Rebecca to cut him out of her life. Yeah. And, you know, when I think about conflict, my mind goes there. That what's the worst that could happen? It could happen.
Yeah.
Right?
And, it is happening.
It is happening. And therefore, you know, I freeze or I avoid or whatever. So how do I overcome that?
Well, I think it actually starts with a seeing thing. It's really hard to practice dangerous love towards somebody who is an object, right? Really hard to practice it. If I believe you're a Nazi or a communist or a socialist or, you know, whatever that popular term is today, a narcissist or whatever it is, right? It's really, really hard to do that. And so I've got to go deeper. That's the start. And I have to really see the humanity. I have to get curious before I can really make that next move. And we call this in Dangerous Love, turn first. And in 70 times seven, I call it taking the risk of embrace. And the idea is that in most conflict, what you hear is, well, I'll apologize when they apologize. I'll call them once they reach out to me and tell me, you know, that they're sorry. But the other side says essentially the same thing. And you'd be shocked that I'd say 90% of the cases, Tom, when I'm sitting there, the other side is demanding that the other side go first, right? That they start. They started it, so they should be the first person to make that move. And so dangerous love is actually asking you to be the person to make that move, regardless of whether you started it or someone else started it, regardless of whether you know what the outcome of that move is going to be, how they're going to react, or, you know, if it's Hank and he is making that move towards his daughter, will she respond? Will she yell at him again? Right? Will she just hang up the phone? He doesn't know that going in, right? We do it because it's the right move. We don't do it to manipulate another person into responding the way that we want them to respond. And I've certainly caught myself in other things saying, okay, if I apologize, what I'm really doing here is getting them to apologize, right? So I'll start with an apology, but now I'm waiting. And now you're going to actually say, well, actually, it was me. Mm-hmm. I was the one who really started that. And we get that sort of smug, yeah, see, I was right. Those apologies never work. People have an amazing radar for them. They know when we're reaching out to the other person, actually just fishing for them to behave in the way that we want them to behave. So I just have to do it because it's the right thing, regardless of what their choices are going to be next. We have to do these things because they're right. And studying the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, one of the things that really impressed me about Martin Luther King and the entire movement was that there were years where they didn't get reciprocation. There were years that nonviolence was responded to with violence, right? When messages of, we don't agree with your policies, but we will not hate you, were the response was hate, right? And the discipline that they had, and part of the discipline was because there was a belief that ran through their system that their oppressors, the people that were mistreating them, were human beings. They were their brothers and sisters. They deeply disagreed with their behaviors. They deeply disagreed with the attitudes that they held. They were working overtime to try to change those attitudes and humanize themselves, but they would not hate. And they would not see their brothers and sisters as enemies. And eventually, love wears you down. And it's the thing that transforms conflict, right? Hate does not beget love, it begets more hate, right? Distance, cutting off, doesn't lessen the space between us. It grows the gap between us. We have to start thinking about what are the tools that we have that invite connection, that heal the space between us. And it's typically not any of the moves that our fear brain is going to think to do. So that dangerous love is being the first person to take that risk. And I love this idea of embrace. It actually came out of a workshop that I was doing with doTERRA, where this woman, we were doing this thing on stage and we were asking, like, just visually, what did it look like to turn first? And she did something no one on that stage had ever done. With our backs to each other, she turned around and just wrapped her arms around me. And it was in front of a bunch of people, and I was a little uncomfortable, you know, at the time. But I thought about, well, what does that look like? And it was really powerful. And there's this theologian, Miroslav Volf, and he was writing about Christianity in the midst of the Balkans War, and he was from Serbia, and he was thinking about this stuff, and he talked about embrace in a really interesting way. Like, the first thing I do when I embrace is I open my arms up. It's vulnerable. It's scary. But it is a signal to the other side that there's something safe. There's a safe space here. The second thing is I actually have to wait. Now they have to either step into the embrace or not step into the embrace, right? This can be a really hard part because I'm trying to be patient. I'm trying to signal to them this is a safe space, but it's their choice of whether they want to step into it or not. Then I close my arms around them, right? I'm reconnecting to them, and that's a really, really powerful moment. But then the fourth one I always think is interesting. I have to let go at some point. I have to open up those arms, and I have to figure out now how to live with this person. Again, those are all actually, interestingly, kind of scary things. Maybe the third part about the actual embrace is the part that isn't that scary. And as a nation, we need to be thinking about what does it look like to open my arms to the other person? What does it look like to be patient and understand if they don't come running into my arms right away, why they might not feel safe or why they may struggle or why they may actually be suspicious about our behavior and why we're doing what it is. We got to be patient. When we embrace, it needs to be genuine. It needs to be felt. And then we have to be able to let go and say that just because we embrace doesn't mean we agree, doesn't mean that we see eye to eye here, but I'm committed to living in a community where your needs are met as well as mine. I'm committed to doing the hard work of collaboration so that all of our needs are met in a way that give us a sense of security, a sense of space and dignity, a sense of identity in the world. And I'm not going to stop until we do that.
We are talking with Chad Ford today. We'll take another break here. Chad Ford is Associate Professor of Religious Studies. He's on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Hiravi Peace Institute. And his book is Dangerous Love. Another book coming out, 70 times 7.
70 times 7, yeah. In February.
Based on the teachings of Jesus, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm going to, as a mediator, read the New Testament and see what was Jesus up and doing in all of these sorts of encounters. I actually think he's a master mediator. I think he has some really good techniques to try to transform conflict. And it's a deep dive in that for Christians. There's some specific focus for members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but also just Christians in general, like how we could model Jesus's behavior.
We're talking with Chad Ford. He is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Utah State University. He's on the Faculty Advisory Board of the Hiravi Peace Institute. We'll have more with Chad Ford following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in November of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest today is Chad Ford. This is the latest episode in our peace-building series. His book is Dangerous Love, and he's an associate professor of religious studies and on the faculty of the advisory board at the Hiravi Peace Institute in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. You're welcome to join us here at 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or you can reach me at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. I've neglected to give out the phone number, but Carl knows our phone number, Carl, right? So you've called in. Thanks for doing that. Carl, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Extremely interesting program. Jack, you need to get down here to southern Utah. People are always fighting. It's either about water, it's about the size of the Bears of Ears National Park. But when I hear someone say, I don't discuss religion or politics, I think to myself, the reason they say that is because they don't know enough about either one to carry on an intelligent conversation about it. But the last part of your discussion here where you're talking about being forgiving and apologizing, you know, I think you have to be really careful with that because you as an attorney or partial attorney, you realize that when somebody apologizes for something, it can open up it opens them up to all kinds of culpability in what the issue is. And lawsuits fly everywhere when someone says, yep, it was my fault. Do you agree with that or not?
Well, Carl, let me start by saying that Carl's my dad's name. I was excited. And he actually lived in St. George for a short period of time. And my son was born on my father's birthday, on Father's Day. Can you believe that? My only son, and his middle name was Carl as well. And so I just thought that was amazing when I heard Carl come in. You know, I appreciate what you're talking about here, Carl, on two fronts. When people say they don't want to talk about politics or religion, you can be absolutely right. One of the reasons might just be I just don't know enough about it to have an intelligent discussion. It also can be that in the past, when I've talked about these topics, it hasn't gone well and has led to, you know, a conversation that maybe has left me feel estranged from a person or left me felt really frustrated in a way that I feel like it's better for my relationship not to talk about those things anymore. And in both of those cases, I would say deciding not to talk about things and trying to stick our head in the sand when religion and politics play such an essential role in our lives, regardless of what our beliefs are, is not going to be the best way forward to collaboratively solve our problems together. If we need to get educated, we should get educated, on those things. And I know that's difficult because so much of our media is partisan in certain ways. So what you hear on MSNBC and what you might hear on Fox News are two different things. I think there's some really interesting people out there right now that are trying to solve that. Isaac Saul's newsletter Tangle, where he tries to talk about the issue from both sides of the political spectrum, is something that I subscribe to and I think is a really cool way to get informed not only on the issues but also informed on how people are talking about the issues both from the left and the right and why, and you get the curiosity there. The fear thing, I think, is often the bigger area. And so when somebody tells that to me, what I hear is, okay, you don't feel safe talking to me about those topics right now in a certain way. So how do I create the space for you to feel safe? And on the last question about apology, you know, it's really interesting. You're right that there are many circumstances where someone has admitted culpability and then people have taken advantage of them and used that to, sue them or it has caused problems for them. But I always sort of think about, again, the response from fear and the response from love. The response from fear is, that's exactly what you're going to do to me. I'm never going to admit that I'm wrong. I'm never going to talk about any mistake that I made because I think you are the sort of person who's going to sue me or take advantage of me or punish me or judge me because of those things. And you see that as an attitude that a lot of people take now, like, I'm not going to admit any mistakes or anything that's wrong. Part of that comes from a space of religious belief for me. In that is not at all what the sort of morals of Scripture actually sort of invite us to do. Like, if something that Scripture is really clear on is that we should be repenting, right? And repenting of the things that where we make mistakes, and that when we do that, we actually open up space for us to see our own humanity, because we do make mistakes, for other people to be able to see that I actually recognize that I've made that mistake and I can see how that's impacted you and hurt you. That's a very humanizing approach. And that my experience in now thousands of mediations is that the most typical response to a genuine accountability and a genuine apology or a sense of, I have hurt you, And I regret it, is not a lawsuit. It's that people actually respond in kind, that they feel a connection, and the breach actually gets bridged together. And that's part of the dangerous love, Carl. I mean, it's making that move, not knowing whether Tom is going to record that and then send it to his attorney and say, okay, we got him right now, or whether that's actually going to touch Tom's heart in a way that's going to reconnect us together. And all I know is that in a community and in relationships, if we live in fear, we're not going to have the va or the space that we really like to have with each other.
So don't you think? Don't you think on ahead. Balance, you have to consider the payoff? In other words, when you go into that situation, what's going to be the payoff? In which way I go? Do I humble myself and repent and say I'm sorry, or do I keep my mouth shut because I don't want to be beat up again by my dad or by whoever, my board of directors or whoever I'm representing?
Yeah. It's a great question, and I can't answer that for every situation. And they're probably, you're right, there probably are circumstances where maybe that is an unsafe space or thing to do. I talk a lot about in Dangerous Love that, you know, if you're in an abusive situation, for example, turning first doesn't necessarily mean that I have to take more abuse or put myself in danger again. And I sort of hear some of that, Carl, in your talk. But I've also known just in my own life and working with a lot of clients, when I have made mistakes and I don't own them, when I don't try to engage in reconciliation, the peace that comes from them not yelling at me, or the peace that comes from me maybe not getting in trouble because I don't say those things, is often dwarfed by the senses of shame and guilt that come from actually knowing that I'm not engaged authentically with you. I'm not actually telling the truth here. I'm not being truthful with you or myself. And while there might be some benefits from it, right, that you can't catch me or, right, I'm going to not be held accountable here, there's a deeper sense where I think it does damage to the relationship in ways that to me are much higher a cost than having to be accountable for the things that for the mistakes that I've made.
Carl, thanks for calling. We're out of time.
You bet.
Appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
Hopefully, we answered your question, at least in part. Thanks for calling, Carl. We are out of time. Interesting discussion. So Chad Ford has been our guest. He is an associate professor of religious studies and on the faculty advisory board of the Harari Peace Institute. You can find his book, Dangerous Love, anywhere you purchase books. The new book's coming out soon-ish?
February.
In February. Okay, coming out pretty soon. 70 times 7 be the name of that one. Right. Chad Ford, thank you so much.
Really appreciate you having on and making these spaces for peace-building discussions. We need them right now.
We sure do. Thanks so much for your contribution. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview of Jerry Anderson was recorded in collaboration with the Silver Reef Museum in Leeds, Utah.
Well, I'm a sculptor. We live at Silver Reef. We've been there 46 years. Fawn and I started looking for houses to buy or maybe something to build. And we went up to Sullivan's place up on the hill here. And he says, you're wearing a Wells Fargo belt buckle. And I said, yeah. And he says, well, I want to show you something. So the next day we went out to Silver Reef, and I fell in love with it because it was a place where the old Wells Fargo building was in disarray. And I thought, well, what we'll do is just make that into a gallery if we restore it. And we did. And so we bought that piece of property out there. It was a half acre for $10,000. And it was beautiful. And then we started building the house about a year after that. And that's it gave me the peace and contentment that you need to do the artwork without people irritating you. We restored the little powder house, and I did a diorama in there of 9 square blocks of old Silver Reef in miniature for people to see. And so little by little, they've restored it, and they've brought the old jailhouse back that was in here. There was a lot of things taken after they found $10,000 worth of gold in one of the old buildings after the miners left. And we've been trying to get some of that stuff back, and we have a lot of people giving stuff back. And it's in the museum now to see. And then Fawn had it. My wife had the Wells Fargo after we restored it with a lot of help from everybody. And she had it for 25 years, keeping it open. And then we let it go about 25 years ago. And now it's owned by Silver Reef Special Service District. I love history. You have to know history to be a sculptor, an artist, and it had a lot of history. There's only two, well, there's only one building there, actually, well, two buildings that survived. Silver Reef is one of the only places in the world where they found silver in sandstone. Leeds annexed us in a few years ago, and it is beautiful there. And that's why we like it, the beautiful rocks, the red cliffs, and the streams that used to go down there. Well, when we moved out there, there were only six houses. Now there's over 100, and it was pristine at that time. And there were three creeks that ran down out of the mountains, and it was just open, beautiful public lands. There were big cottonwood trees growing along the three creeks, and eventually over the years that was taken out. And you can tell the bite of the people that come out from the different all over the world, and they come there. But it's changed quite a bit. It used to be that you could look out the window over Zion or any place and it was crystal clear, but now in the past few years it's kind of fogged over, and there's a lot of different smoke and things that come out of Vegas and St. George now. But it was beautiful at that time. We have a little jewel right there in the Wells Fargo. There's thousands of people a year that come out there from all over the world, and they're lucky to go out there. We were one of the first. The miners were the first. We're the second, and there'll be thirds, fourths, and fifths going out. And they'll enjoy it, too, because we have the best view in the world.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,